emotional climate, meaning making, identity, reflection, and well-being shape not only how young people learn, but who they become over time. This conversation with Jim Pellegrino and Carol Lee brings many of these themes together. Because once we recognize that learning is deeply human and developmental, another set of questions naturally emerges. What does it actually mean to understand something deeply? What kinds of knowledge matter? What kinds of thinking should schools cultivate? And what kinds of learning prepare young people not only for work or college, but for thoughtful participation in a complex and democratic society? Jim Pellegrino's work has helped shape some of the most important ideas in contemporary learning science: deep learning, transfer, adaptive expertise, disciplinary learning, and the challenge of designing instruction and assessment that cultivate understanding rather than drive surface-level performance. Carol Lee's work reminds us that cognition can never be separated from culture, identity, language, history, and lived experience. She challenges us to recognize the immense intellectual and interpretive resources young people already bring into classrooms, and to rethink whose knowledge, whose histories, and whose cultural practices schools value and sustain. Together, Jim and Carol invite us beyond narrow debates between skills and content or between cognition and culture. Instead, they help us imagine learning as a process of interpretation, reasoning, of meaning-making, identity formation, and engagement with complex social realities. You hear discussions about rigor, transfer, historical consciousness, civic reasoning, equity, and democratic participation. And underneath those conversations is a deeper question: what kinds of educational experiences help human beings develop the capacity to think deeply, engage complexity, collaborate across difference, and participate meaningful in a collective life? And perhaps most importantly, this conversation reminds us that rigor and humanity are not opposites. Deep intellectual work is made possible through relationships, emotional safety, cultural grounding, collaborative inquiry, and opportunities for young people to wrestle with meaningful questions that matter in their lives and in their communities. These are questions both deeply cognitive and deeply human, and I'm honored to welcome Jim Pellegrino and Carol Lee into this conversation. Thank you so much for joining us. As I've told you, I have and I continue to learn so much from your work and from interacting with you. Let's start by talking about what learning actually is. Jim, across your work on deep learning and transfer, and Carol, in your work on cultural modeling and disciplinary learning, you both push us to rethink what learning actually is. Not just the acquisition of knowledge, but something that is fundamentally social, cultural, and developmental. If we start there, what do you think schools most fundamentally misunderstand about learning and how it actually happens?
I think one of the things that's interesting, and David, you and I, with Pam and others, have been engaging in this long-term discussions about this notion of a science of learning and development. And I have said repeatedly that I think we're at an interesting Kuhnian moment where there are many long-held, deeply seated beliefs that have been so internalized and that they're reflected both in research and in practice, that the question of what are the kinds of experiences people at all levels of the system are going to need to wrestle with their assumptions. And one of them is that, and it's ironic because it's like there's been these two pathways around thinking about learning. One pathway, which I think is still the most dominant, is the top-down telling. You are a recipient of something that somebody, gives you. And that there are these separate entities having to do with motivation and engagement, and they're entities, and you have them or you don't have them. I think that's the biggest challenge to overcome. I gave a talk a couple of years ago at AERA where I said that my new data collection tool is my cell phone looking at my grandchildren, and they give me the most clear indication of learning as interconnected, as emotional, as deeply engaged, where they come up, we can invite them over for whatever and think they're going to sit down. They're not going to sit down. They're up moving around, exploring in ways that we hadn't even remotely conceptualized. So I think it's the understanding that emotions, relationships, perceptions of self, others, task are all integrated to any form of learning, and that learning that we are disposed from our evolution as a species to be curious, to be investigative, to explore, to try to figure things out. And I think that's the biggest problem, that schooling is organized as a top-down cognitive siloed focus of telling kids stuff.
I'll just build on that a little bit because I think Carol has framed it very well. I think the misunderstanding or the misconception that has been perpetuated now for a long time is that learning is basically a purely cognitive activity. That essentially, what learning is acquiring information that is presented by authority as the kinds of knowledge we want kids to acquire. And it ignores the social, emotional, cultural, developmental aspect of this because it's largely a transfer model rather than an acquisition, development, elaboration. And I think one of the things that's really funny about this, because we've known this for a long time, is regardless of what I tell you, what you represent is some understanding or representation of that. It is not veridical. If I tell you X, you have an interpretation of that that's based upon prior experience. What else is happening? So we have this, we can think about this in terms of the learning environment we create is a learning environment that ignores the social, emotional, developmental aspects of the learning process. And Carol gave a great example of little kids interacting with tools and other individuals in terms of developing an understanding of something where it isn't just simply, this is a fact. This is something you need to know. So I think when we think about school or formal education, we have to look at what is the nature of the learning environment that's been created? What is happening in that space that deals with the cognitive, the social, emotional, interpersonal dynamics? And in many cases, the social, the cultural, the interactive parts of it don't exist because it is a communication between student and teacher, directed by the teacher.
When I was listening to Carol and I was thinking about not only is the dominant model one of banking, if to use a Freirean term, where teachers are making deposits into empty heads, but there is a comparable model in intervention work, which Irving Goffman once referred to as tinkering. He wrote an essay in his book Asylums on the vicissitudes of the tinkering trade about thinking about psychiatrists and people who work on people's heads. And when I was listening to you, Jim, not the same thing that you're talking about in terms of how learning unfolds and all the ways in which people give their own selves and their culture to what's happening to make their own representation. The same thing happens in interventions, where we have an intervention science that ends up saying we can do X and we're going to get Y, when in reality, what happens is not just the X you're doing, but what people do with the X and how they act on that X.
I think it's also how they understand that X, what interpretation they make of what is being done, what's being transacted. Because again, what is fundamental about the nature of learning and development is that we interpret things that are part of our environment. Things said to us, things done to us, who else is in the space. why we're hearing this, why we're participating in this activity. So we have to understand that it's not just I tell you something and that's what you represent. It is you represent that in the context of a whole host of other things that are of the environment. And then, so learning is inherently a representation of what's happening in the space that I'm in, who else is in it, what do I understand about why this is happening, and do I care?
So one other dimension of this, I think, is not only how learning is organized, but what is it that we're hoping people learn in various settings? There is a kind of knowledge that one can, quote unquote, acquire by being told, that one can memorize, that has some functions in life. But deep understanding, and if we're thinking in the context of schooling, and I think in terms of the variety of content areas, including the humanities that we typically teach in the context of public schooling at least, that the development of deep conceptual understanding in mathematics, for example, that allows you to wrestle with complex problems in the in your personal life, in the public domain, right? So we, for example, in the civic domain, will get statistics that are intended to serve as basic warrants for some policy, but are not rooted mathematically accurate, that you can't interrogate if you don't have deep conceptual understanding. And conceptual understanding does not evolve from telling and simple memorization. So I think that's another important dimension of this. I'd like to also add, before I forget it, that the National Academy of Education has a project that is focusing on what it means to understand complexity in human development. And we are in the process of putting together cases. Typically, they're video cases, and they're about real people, in many cases, children, that we want to be able to share both with the research and a larger public audience to help people see that when we talk in the abstract about the complexity of human learning and development, it just sounds so complicated. Thinking, feeling, perceptions, identity is multi, learning unfolding in microgenetic time and cultural historical time and ontogenetic. We could go on and on. It just sounds so all over the place that it's hard to grapple your head around it. But we're trying to create these video cases where this is real and you can actually see it. We see it every day. We just don't have, if you will, conceptual tools to formally theorize what we're seeing. But if the complexity is real, you're going to see it. And that's where, for me, this whole issue of this observation, I've got grown grandkids and little grandkids. It's the little grandkids primarily. And all of this, every bit of the complexity that I see, I'm able now in interesting ways to try to put theory to what it is that I'm observing that I know I have to pay attention.
Jim, before we go on to the next issue, do you want to add anything to what Carol just said?
I think Carol articulated it nicely, the complexity of what we're dealing with when we're talking about learning and development. I think also I want to touch on one thing that she said, which is that what we're actually striving for in the, with respect to learning and knowing is conceptual understanding, what we call deep, the product of a process of deeper learning, which gets you to foundational understandings that are durable and transferable. They allow you to actually understand a range of situations and then apply that knowledge in particular ways. It is not a surface level understanding or particular individual cases. It is what are the general principles? So when Carol was talking about cases of understanding what's happening or individuals understanding situations, like something you might encounter in the newspaper or trying to listen to something on TV. One of the things is, can you evaluate the quality of the information that you're being presented, the argument, the evidence? And this is one of the, I think one of the biggest problems we have today, whether it's statistical information, because we all know it's very easy to lie with statistics. How you represent things can distort things in particular ways, leading to an interpretation. But I think we've learned, and Carol has demonstrated this in areas of literacy. We know about it in the areas of mathematics and in science. Fundamentally, we want individuals to understand the nature of reasoning in that area and what counts as evidence, what counts as argument, what counts as things that we can apply and use in productive ways in new situations, because we're always encountering new information. The question is, what tools do we have to understand that new information in light of deeper principles, whatever the domain is, whether it's history, civics, science, mathematics, or literature.
I'd also like to add, because as much as the two of us talk, you may not get through all your questions, David.
It's okay. Totally fine.
But there is also an issue when we're thinking about deeper learning in relationship to content knowledge. And we could think about this as an epistemological issue of understanding that, in some sense, irregardless of the discipline, there's a for really complex challenges. Contestation over norms, for example, or what counts as evidence, are evolving. And it becomes really important, to understand that, because you can't push the boundaries of the explanatory power of whatever intellective resources you're bringing to deal with a real world complex problem with the assumption that even all experts are going to come to the question with the same norms for what counts as evidence. And in the context of a democracy of the sort that we, that at least had been structured, has been set up to allow space for contestation that we don't have to all agree. And at the end of the day, it might be that it is the ethical dimension over which we need the deepest sort of congruence to figure out what we can disagree over and still keep moving forward. For example, with COVID and the whole issue of vaccines, and there are these contested kinds of interests, the understanding, for example, that scientific evidence in the field of medicine is always probabilistic, that vaccine isn't going to mean you're not going to get COVID or whatever the disease may be, because those viruses are pretty smart, pretty adaptive, right? But it just increases the likelihood that you won't. But if you're coming from the assumption that the medical knowledge or medical decisions in the public domain are absolutely definitive, then you're going to run into to problems where we cannot agree and then we fight each other.
We could go on and on about this because there was something I read a while ago when I was trying to understand, or was reading actually about the debate with respect to evolution versus alternative conceptualizations, particularly intelligent design. And the article was in the New York Times, and succinctly what it pointed out is the difference between a scientific argument in terms of a theory and how one theory replaces another versus a legal argument in which essentially, if let's say I'm defending you in a murder case, I don't, what all I need to do to create reasonable doubt is indicate there's something in the chain of evidence that is lacking. There's information lacking. That allows me to substitute an alternative theory about who did it without having to prove it. That's a legal argument. And in fact, those who were behind the intelligent design argument were largely legal scholars. Whereas in a scientific argument, if I'm going to propose a different theory, I have to show that it does everything the old theory did as well as something else. That's a very different set of principles on which we argue.
If, in fact, let me push or elaborate on that, Jim, a little further. Another thing that distinguishes the legal position from the scientific position is what lawyers learn in law school is to distinguish between what they call the facts, the final decision, and the dicta and the rationale. And ultimately, while good scientific work is elegant, it always addresses the nuances. It addresses the competing theories. What is dicta is not just dicta, it's part of the main story. And that's a very different mindset. Carol, Jim has talked about the implications of this work for different disciplinary approaches. And one disciplinary approach that you have been very influential on and very concerned with is civic reasoning and discourse. And I would ask you to apply this conversation to the key issues of civic reasoning and discourse that are so central to what is going on in our country right now.
So the National Academy of Education pulled together an array of scholars and practitioners from across a variety of disciplines to address the question of educating particularly young people to engage in civic reasoning and discourse. We've completed that work back in 2020 with the report, and we are now have available on our website a series of reports for practitioners to illustrate how civic reasoning, support for civic reasoning, can be integrated into content area teaching in science, mathematics, literacy across the curriculum, and history of social studies. That civic reasoning, in terms of thinking about sort of prototypical ways that we think about issues of learning, is typically viewed as memorization of some facts in the context of the United States about US system of governance, the Constitution, etc. Most young people in the K-12 sector, at best, like in Illinois, you'd be required to take at seventh and eighth grade a US Constitution test, Illinois Constitution test, and you may have a US history class in high school, most of which, again, going back to the banking model, are viewed as the sort of memorization of facts. Whereas certainly today, and this was one of the inspirations for why we started this work in the first place, is that we're dealing with such complicated issues. So we're thinking about what's going on right now around the TSA funding, for example, or what's going on in Iran, across the globe, that we've argued that civic reasoning requires knowledge, clearly, but that knowledge is, for purposes of civic reasoning, largely conceptual. It requires a disposition to value complexity and to not be satisfied with solutions to complex problems, and that it involves ethics and morality, particularly in terms of empathy for others, so that when you're wrestling with complex issues over which we have contestation in the public domain, for the purpose of a democratic system of governance that we have that has in all of its is structured explicitly to accommodate difference, that, excuse me, you need to be able to consider not only your own self-interest, but also the interest of others. Because if you're only thinking about your own self-interest, you'll never be able to come to consensus. And if you can't come to consensus, the forms of which contestation take place can lead to things like civil war, which we've had, but we've been able to avoid. And one of the things that is, and we have in the report sort of illustrations by content area. For example, topical areas that are very much open and supported by civic reasoning, along with this sort of knowledge and dispositions and ethics and values and disposition to empathize with others as illustrations in the report, all of which are available free of line on the NAED website.
Jim, before I go on, any last thoughts here?
I would just add that I think what Carol has laid out, what the Academy laid out in that compendium, is really helps us understand what is the nature of this process, what is involved And of course, knowledge is involved. I would argue that if you look at contemporary standards, for example, the frameworks we have for K-12 science education, you find the same kind of thinking in terms of how you look at the nature of the scientific process, the reasoning that goes on. And it isn't just about facts. Obviously, you need to understand what they call core ideas, but you also need to understand the nature of the reasoning process, the practices that scientists use, and that we need to then carry over into our own lives as we evaluate information and evidence that's presented to us, whether it's about vaccines or particular treatments, that again, there's a process of reasoning and a process of discourse with respect to how ideas get exchanged and how you come to some understanding of what is the predominant understanding at this point in time, taking into account, as Carol said, other issues that go well beyond the science, which is, and you see this in arguments about should we have wind turbines? Should we not? Should we allow certain things? Now we're debating should we have data centers in places because of the impact it might have on natural resources, the amount of water that's needed, the amount of electricity. These are not just technical issues, they're socially cognitive, socio emotional, and cultural issues. So I think we need to understand the dimensions of the kind of thinking we want individuals to be able to do across a variety of contexts, because that's what we're going to encounter as adults.
But I'd like to just add on to that in terms of the importance of dispositions. So, if we're thinking about the data center, we're having those contestations right now here in the Chicago region, actually, is that it is not uncommon in the complex dilemmas that we face in the civic domain that on both sides of a question, there are legitimate sets of concerns. And that part of what often is invoked in trying to determine how to move forward are often at the heart of it, some ethical dimensions of the goods and the bad, if you will, that may unfold depending on the position that we take. I want to add, and probably somewhere in your questions, David, you were going to get to it anyway, and I understand you're going to be interviewing Mary Helen Immedino Yang. I used to tell Margaret Beale Spencer that she should hire me as her PR person. I think now Mary Helen should do the same for me. But the work that she has done on what she calls transcendent thinking, I think, is very relevant here. The transcendent thinking, as I understand it, involves the invocation, an intent to invoke explanatory explanations for phenomena that go beyond the immediate event, but that are applicable across a variety of settings and therefore becomes very useful as knowledge and dispositions because it allowed you to interrogate an array of situations that you may unfold that's very different than a memorization of some facts. And among the things, and I'm not going to explain this well because I'm still wrestling understanding the biology of all of this, is that one, she found that the evidence from the work that she's done in neuroimaging, in the longitudinal study she did, that their long-term positive developmental outcomes in terms of resilience and the ability to establish meaningful relationships over time for the young people, in this case, adolescents who engage in what she called transcendent thinking. The other dimension is the importance of relationships, the importance of participation in cultural practices has been well established for decades. However, I think that work has been taken up largely as something that you pay attention to if you are of a particular political persuasion, but it empirically is not necessarily the scientific case, right? And so we in the research world get caught up, and Jim, as the quantitative researcher in this crew here, we will have these little isolated factors of he predicts this, or we've got a measure of self-efficacy and
Mm-hmm.
self-efficacy or executive controls or entity, and you have it or you don't have it, and we can put it into the equation and predict something that's going to happen, right? Versus the work in the field of epigenetics. About 10 years ago, I suddenly learned a little bit about that. Scientific evidence that genes follow experience, they don't determine. Genes are adaptive based on experience in the world. The neuroimaging work, again, for me, just reading Mary Helen, that the regions of our brain that have a variety of specializations are always talking to one another. Dialogic relationships, not linear. Executive control predicts what's going to happen in the default network. They are in dialogic interaction. It's the default network that in the young people who engage in what she called transcendent thinking, it was a greater activation of interaction among the regions of the brain that dealt with creativity and exploration versus executive control, which was largely about, I'm going to do this in the moment, you know what I mean, for now. And getting her, I think, in this series to talk about that for me is a very powerful sort of warrant for the notion of rigorous, deep conceptual learning involving the opportunities to explore, to test things out, to tinker, etc., that there's a long-term developmental benefit for that is based not on the fact that I'm culturally responsive and I want you to do what I do in cultural modeling, but to say that our evolution as a species has positioned us to be adaptive. We're not as adaptive as the viruses. Viruses, at one level, are smarter perhaps than we are. And one of the reasons, even around the notion of civic reasoning, etc., that I think the preparation of generations of young people to want to really wrestle with complexity that is real, is I always say, Mama Nature says, when I become very engaged, I revert into Black English, she don't need us. She got millions of planets and stars. What kind of life is out there? We define life as it exists on the earth, like there's not other forms of life in all of the universes. And the trick of the viruses is their adaptability, their ability to live inside our body, you know what I mean, as hosts. That the topics that we're talking about are real. They have both short-term and term consequences and impact, and we ignore the complexity at our peril.
I think what you have both been talking about here is developing habits of mind and dispositions that would enable human beings to leverage their potentiality that is evolutionary so that they could be more adaptive and would not look so stupid in competition with the viruses. Because a lot of the noise that happens between individuals prevents them from being adaptive.
I think this sort of foray into the broader perspective on development and the brain and the environment is takes us back to what is it about what we do in schooling right now, which runs counter to that.
That's right.
Okay. What's the nature of the environment that we find in classrooms, whether we're talking about elementary classrooms, middle school, high school, or even post-secondary? If we look at those environments, we see them as essentially only focused on a very narrow aspect of, you might say, that developmental, that learning process. We challenge students in a particular way, but not one that allows them to work together to invent solutions, to be creative, because we're so tied to the dictation of a particular curriculum, a particular sequence of objectives that are largely manifest in terms of how we test kids. I want to interject into this conversation the fact that a lot of what we do, some is partly a function of historical conceptualizations of the nature of knowing and learning, but it's also been dictated very much by the nature of the assessment processes that we use for policy and other purposes. If we look historically in the United States and compare the United States to almost every other country on the globe, we have a very perverse approach to essentially benchmarking the nature of learning and knowing, and that is the use of standardized tests and particularly used for accountability in an educational system. Other countries do not do what we do, and we find if we look at the environments that exist in places like Singapore and Finland, in Hong Kong, in Estonia, across the globe, we find a very different approach to the nature of how students and teachers interact, what the degrees of autonomy are with respect to what we want to have accomplished, and the role of assessment in those systems. Because we do need assessment, we do need, but we don't need to be dominated by the kinds of assessments that have come to be part of standardized testing in the United States. There's a variety of forces that act upon the educational system. And one of the most pernicious of those has been federal and state policy with respect to assessment. Not just how much of it we have, but what gets assessed. That tends to drive education in a particular direction with respect to what's happening between students, teachers, and domains of understanding.
So I think one interesting dimension of learning and development that we haven't addressed is learning at the systems level. So one of the things that I have often wrestled with is, Jim, and I've written about this, why is it with the empirical evidence, whatever you may think about the international assessments, TIMSS and et cetera, and the fact that there are no international assessments in which the United States scores in the top, say, 10%. And there's clear empirical evidence of the differences in the practice with regard to the organization of schooling, the organization and use of assessments, the preparation of professionals to teach. You would think if this was purely a question of logic, and we like to go around saying United States is the best country in the world, blah, 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 that we might at least consider some of what these other countries do, and we don't. And so, in terms of this science of learning and development piece, the notion of macro level, cultural, historical level factors as sources of influence, and the question of how people in a given society, in this case, the United States, at different moments in cultural historical time, take up those meta narratives, and what sort of institutions, they don't have to be macro level, they may be at the level of a neighborhood, invite people to wrestle with those assumptions. Important dimension of this, because again, if you were just thinking about whatever quote unquote logic is supposed to be, you would assume that if everybody else is beating you on this thing, you might think about what they're doing. And we absolutely refuse to, because again, I think that we have some very deep-seated notions of individualism, of competition, of ability as fixed, of despite what we say, we're fine with hierarchies, because when those guys wrote, "All men are created equal," they meant literally white men with property. They didn't mean poor white men. They didn't mean women. Women didn't get the right to vote till 1920, from 1776 or whatever to 1920. There's a deep-seated sort of intergenerational transmission, that's probably not the best verb to use, of these beliefs, and that we have to, and as we are thinking as stakeholders about the transformation, for example, of educational systems, have to wrestle with the macro level processes of how systems operate. And I was thinking earlier, Jim, when you were talking about the evolution of scientific evidence, Again, among the complexities of understanding people's or even professionals' positions that operate not simply in the context of the discipline, if you will, I'm in a medical professional, whatever. How is it that you have, we did have, right, a head of the health department in Florida who said you shouldn't have vaccinations, who's a medical doctor? He's not just a medical doctor in the neighborhood. The guy is head of the whole daggum system, or the people that Robert Kennedy has now put on the whatever the review committee that even signed the evolution and uptake of scientific knowledge unfolds in a social, economic, and political system, which makes even more complex around the notion of civic reasoning to be able to understand what are the variety of forces at work, if you will, that are influencing how not or the reading boards, right, and the science of reading. And so when the health committee most recently has some sort of review thing, they don't invite the literacy scholars. They invite the people who already believe in this science of reading. And despite the fact that they already invested, Jim, right, millions of dollars on the reading first, on decoding, developed great diagnostic assessments at one level, curriculum and PE. When it was over, after they had spent the millions of dollars, did a meta-analysis and found out, yeah, kids got better at decoding. They could say the words, but they still couldn't comprehend. And the fact that empirical data exists, just like the empirical data around the differences in what high-achieving nations do, you know, around assessment, organization of learning, it doesn't matter. We're back at it again. So the issue of the transformation of the condition, this gets to the civic reasoning thing, is from a quote-unquote scientific perspective, what is entailed in conceptual change? What are the conditions that have to be in place for people to reconsider things that they think they already know and that are well established? And the last point before I forget it with my whole brain is another, I think, interesting dimension of the complexity of human learning. And this is total guesswork on my part. Managing contestation is endemic to all forms of life, trees, bugs, viruses, and us. We're always going to fight. Wars are not going to go away. It's almost going back to the survival of the fittest thing at one point. And that there's something about some kinds of contestation open up opportunities for new explorations. And other forms of contestation are just negative and people die and bad things happen. But both of those conditions are going to be in place. And so I think that another dimension of holistic kinds of learning environments are ones that give kids, at least in the K-12 public sector, opportunities to wrestle with the fact that we don't always agree, and perhaps socializing a disposition to have some empathy when you're engaged in disputations and disagreements with people.
You covered a lot there. I just want to make one comment which speaks to this issue of international comparative things. The National Center for the Education and the Economy has done over many years case studies and analyses, and they continue to do that. And one of the things that is distinctly different about how we have organized education in the United States versus what's happening in many of the countries that perform exceedingly well is that, and this is part of our dilemma, and I'm not sure that there's a way around this. We are a local control country. So that what happens in school is very much determined by the local school district and the individuals running that. The state has certain degrees of dictation, but not much, and the federal government has even less. So the federal government can say you have to have standards, but it doesn't say what standards you have to have or what the curriculum is supposed to focus. States make those choices, but then ultimately, it's up to the districts and the teachers to figure out what that means and how it's going to be enacted. That means that we have, if I think about comparing the United States to any country, we have 50 countries, okay? And we have 50 different school systems and more than that, because we don't have, in the state of Illinois, we don't have one system. And let's take it down to the level of our own home, Chicago. The Chicago Public Schools, as a central office, cannot dictate to the schools in Chicago what they must teach, because it is local site control that. And you know that because you run a couple of schools in Chicago. So I think we have to understand there's other dynamics operating in the social political realm, which are actually embedded into who the United States is. And one of those is this principle of local control. That has prof effects.
But just to build on that, again, I think that this conversation points, as I was saying earlier, to the importance of systems level understanding. How do systems operate? I think there's interesting work, for example, around studies of complex dynamic systems that could potentially begin to prove useful, because there are many interacting parts that don't interact on a linear basis,
That's right.
and that are and that again, I think from an evolutionary perspective, that one of the drivers of human engagement is self-interest that can be socialized to be more public, right? That people who go into the military or go into the police force or firefighters, et cetera, are socialized to develop a sort of moral disposition to put oneself, to put others above one's own self-interest. But this issue of self-interest is always involved, right? And so one of the interesting counterparts is, if you take a country like Japan, and I've written about this as well, where you have, or even China for that matter, where you have a centralized system of education, and the state dictates the textbooks, the assessments, the whole thing. But they counterbalance that, for example, in Japan, with professional standards around what they call lesson study, where in the school that I end up can be in some small town, Tokyo or otherwise, there is a value in the profession for the community of teachers in my school to wrestle with what does this textbook and this assessment mean for the kids who are in front of me, right? So that there's an attempt to balance out the collective interests of the state on the one hand, with a deep understanding that learning does have to be adaptive to the people who are in front of you in the communities that you're operating in. One of the ironies, Jim, I understand that the federal level that will foreclose the opportunity to teach phonics in a particular way. You can't do that. It's dumb, because the only way that the federal government can force anything is either the enticement of money, or if you say it's unconstitutional, and they've tried it before and it hasn't worked, but it doesn't
Wow.
stop.
Let me just add one thing just now. There's an interesting segue from where you started, Jim, in terms of assessment and where Carol came in. As you probably know, Michael Fullan has done important work where he really pointed out the extent to which we use the wrong levers for system change. And he really talks about the things you have talked about, Jim, in terms of the obsessive on high stakes testing. When I first talked to Michael about the science of learning and development, his response was, "This is a great model for how young people learn and develop. It lacks a theory of change, lacks the theory of system change that Carol's talking about." And I think that's really important. I would add historically that what I had hoped to do with the science of learning and development work initially, but we never were able to do it was to talk about the issue of implementation. It is very nice to talk about all these things, but how do we make it work? And when we reconvene, one is for both of you to really be addressing how people can make this work right now in the spaces that are available to them, in spite of the fact that the high stakes tests are going and so forth. Thank you very much.
To be continued.